I'm Rachel, the creative director for Ram Dass's Love Serve Remember Foundation, and I'd like to welcome you to our Inner Academy, a virtual Dharma hall where our family of wisdom teachers will help you navigate your daily life by bringing ancient wisdom into a modern context. With over 200 hours of audio and video teachings, meditations, and practices from teachers like Ram Dass, Krishna Dass, Sharon Salzberg, Jack Kornfield, Roshi Joan Halifax, Joseph Goldstein, and many more, the Inner Academy is your core resource for finding balance, presence, and navigating the ups and downs of your daily life. The Inner Academy has guidance for every step of your journey. Choose from an annual or monthly membership and gain access to past and future courses, retreat replays, virtual community, and much more. If you've been familiar with Love Serve Remember Foundation for a while, you'll know that most of our offerings are given freely or on a sliding scale basis. So when you subscribe to the Inner Academy, you're paying it forward and bolstering our ability to continue creating accessible offerings for all in the future, as Ram Dass wished for us to do. Be here now and start your journey with Ram Dass's Inner Academy today. For more, visit ramdass.org/innerAcademy.
Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app today to get free delivery on your first three orders, while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Welcome to the Sharon Salzberg Meta Hour. This podcast is a reflection of Sharon's very clear and profound vision of the heart-mind path. If you are interested in supporting Sharon's podcast, please go to BeHereNowNetwork.com/Sharon.
No, I have a house.
Oh, but you have a TV in the house.
Yeah.
I don't know why I'm shocked. I shouldn't be. I think I made you to be this sort of austere figure. It's so unfair. There's Dr. Johnson, Dr. Johnson, the great 18th century moralist, sort of famously said, when a man is tired of London, he's tired of life, for there is in London all that life affords. That he's a man of the city. Do you feel that way?
Yes.
I'm suspicious of people who don't want to live here. And I know everyone doesn't. I truly don't understand why. And I know not everyone is me. God. And I know different people like different things, and that's all fine. But I go, well, yeah, but what would you do without film form? I'm like, well, where do you go to the theater? So don't you miss all that when you're? But you see, so you have it here. But why doesn't everyone want to live here? Why do they hate us?
I actually experienced tremendous kindness here as well. I know people think that.
Why do you sound surprised? Like, of course, you experienced tremendous kindness.
I'm surprised because of the
Look at these people. These are nice people.
They're such nice people. Can't see them that well, but.
Well, they're not. They're not that nice.
But you know how everyone. The rap is that New York is so cynical and remorseless, and it's going to grind you down, and it's a dog-eat-dog world, and people step all over you. But I experienced tremendous kindness here.
Yeah, me too. Can you think of a particular example?
Well, when I moved to my friend's apartment on 9th Street and 5th Avenue, I had a doorman for the first time in my life.
La la.
Yes. And I was obviously kind of lost. I was here for the first time in years and years and years. And just the way they take care of me, or the way they go out of their way to, make sure I was okay. And I experienced that all the time.
Oh, yeah. People when they know something you don't know, and people are very generous with their knowledge. And if you just have the courage to ask them, except for the people who panic and don't actually know how to get to that store, but we'll tell you anyway. And you're 20 blocks before you realize they didn't know anything. They couldn't just say, people, do you find that to be so? People can't say, I don't know.
Well, it's kind of a minor thing in my mind, because I remember I lived in India for a few years where it's really a pronounced characteristic.
Oh, is it?
Like it would be very shameful to say you didn't know.
So it's better to give wrong information?
Every moment. Any moment of the day.
Really?
Yeah, because you would lose a lot,
You would lose face. Or self-esteem. But why don't you lose face 2 minutes later when you've sent someone in the wrong direction?
Because you don't see them again.
Right, of course, you sent them off a cliff of some kind, yeah.
Yeah, they're walking and walking and walking and walking and walking.
Wow. I didn't know that was a particularly Indian thing. I think of it as a New York thing, or a me thing, because I panicked. my favorite book about your block, do you know this, William Dean Howells, who used to be the first editor of the Atlantic Monthly, and he wrote a book called The Hazard of New Fortune. He wrote this book in 1890, and it's about this this literary family from Boston, which is a literary city, comes to New York, a commercial city, to work at this new technology thing, a magazine.
Whoa.
I know, it's crazy. They're trying to look for an apartment in your neighborhood.
Really?
This is a wonderful book. And they can't find an apartment because no one can, even in 1890. And they're exhausted from walking around the village looking for apartments. And they sit down in Washington Square Park, and they're struck by the incredibly exotic immigrants that seem to be also having their lunch there because they're from Italy. Great book. You should not right this minute, but go out later and read it. Do you figure you'll always have a foot in both places?
It's a little hard to think about always,
do you think you'll often? No, that isn't the right word.
I mean, for the foreseeable future, that's how I imagine my life, yeah. I mean, I vote in Massachusetts, so I'm a resident there.
Oh, it doesn't matter. There. Here, there, we're right, there, we're wrong. It's so upsetting. Now I'm too depressed to go on. I know, but yeah. All right. Well, now I feel horrible. Allow me my self-deception.
Let's think about Washington Square Park.
That'll it's so beautiful. There's a lot of Italian immigrants there, and they're wonderful. So, Sharon, what's your thing?
My thing is actually the Statue of Liberty.
It's like recognition applause when you mention a celebrity.
Well, some people know also because that book I was writing when I moved to 9th Street and 5th Avenue has a whole section on the Statue of Liberty. Because in Hinduism, where there's, like a pantheon of deities, you sort of have your own special inspiration, and they're all different, maybe they're like mischievous or scholarly or musical or something, and that is like the central figure in your thinking about who do I want to be or how do I want to manifest in this world. So for me, oddly enough, it's the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, the Statue of Liberty is fabulous.
It's fabulous.
We were talking earlier, the one regret I had about it is you were speaking about how the statue is manifested also on many ashtrays and hideous tchotchkes, and that it seemed a downside of the decline of smoking, that it's been a sad loss to the ashtray industry and a chance to see crappy versions. But you brought a more elegant version, I think, for the show and tell portion. Do you want to show them?
Sure. Well, I said I do have many... I think of the Statue of Liberty, or I see a depiction of the Statue of Liberty, however schlocky, and I feel this thrill go through my body. And I actually do have lots of little green things, like eraser heads and tchotchkes. I do. And my current sublet close to here is on the second floor of this building facing Fifth Avenue. And so when double-decker buses go by, we're kind of on the same level, and I thought, I saw an ad for a 6-foot-tall Statue of Liberty, and I thought for a moment of getting it and putting it right in the window, so it's like there, but it's like a little studio apartment, it'd be like having a roommate. This is something a friend bought me. She bought it on the street from a homeless woman who had painted it And it says, "We love the Statue of Liberty. There are still some good people living in this world." Oh. And I took it off my wall just to.
It's
bring it
wonderful because I thought I was sort of preparing for you to bring kitsch, and it's not kitsch
at
all.
I was
it's just
kitsch.
Moving.
Yeah.
Is there a particular aspect of the Statue of Liberty that you're thinking of when you put her in the Pantheon?
Yeah, well, it's the welcome. You know, those of you who feel you belong nowhere, you have a home. You know, you're the wretched, you know, like, you know, I felt like that's like being enfolded in. Somebody loves you somewhere, and it's me. That's the Statue of Liberty.
Yeah, we will.
Yeah.
It seems to me that also, unlike the flag, which gets co-opted for different political perspectives, especially for a long time, like all through the Vietnam era, the flag was associated with the right. And just show an American flag meant you were somehow in favor of the Vietnam War. I don't think that's true, the Statue of Liberty. Mm-hmm. Do you? Has anyone co-opted it in that way? Not politically. Commercially, yes. Pretty much anybody who sells anything has exploited the Statue of Liberty, which in a way humanizes her. And I checked a couple. The first one I could find was, it's always replacing the torch. There was one in 1890. I mean, it only went in 1886. In 1890, there's an ad for the Statue of Liberty's holding up a spool of silk thread. Apparently very good silk thread. But she's held 7-Up. Bottles of 7-Up, ice cream cones of every kind of crappy ice cream, glasses of beer, name your beer. But somehow I don't mind. Do you?
A little bit.
Yeah? You think we should have a keep your hands off her?
No, I just, it isn't quite the unconditionally loving message. It's like, buy this beer, you know?
No, it's not. It is, I guess, implicitly dismissing another beer, an inferior beer. We don't want that beer. the official name, the actual name, Liberty Enlightening the World, right? Designed by Frederick Bartholdi, who did the Eiffel Tower, right? Hmm. Right? Come on, this is an educated crowd, right? Didn't Bartholdi do that? Built by Gustav Eiffel. And you know, when the French sent it here, a lovely gift, by the way. But there was no pedestal. Does everyone know this story?
No.
You don't know this story?
No, I just love her. I don't really study.
Let me tell you something about. No, she's great. We all have. But so there was no pedestal, and she was for the first few years. We had nowhere to put her, and she was in pieces in Madison Square Park. That you could go and the torch was there, and you could go up the steps, up the arm, into the torch. But it's only 25 feet high, so this fundraising drive organized by Joseph Pulitzer, when he had his newspaper, and they raised $120,000, which is a lot of money in 1886, and almost no contributions for more than a dollar.
Oh, so nice.
That's pretty Statue of Liberty.
That's pretty nice.
So they raised this money, and they put the pedestal on Liberty Island. We did that. But in a way, it seems like, oh, the French. They're so chintzy. They send you the statue, but no place to put it. It's like when people give you a print, but they don't frame it. You sort of think, oh, what jerks. You know that? Am I just ungrateful? Because a present shouldn't be more work for you.
I agree with that. But, there's that whole theory that you have to invest. You have to participate. Otherwise, you don't appreciate it, as much as you would were, the sweat of your brow or your own labors.
Oh, that's very good. So
involved.
Instead of thinking of the French as jerks, I guess what I meant is the French, those psychologically astute
that's
people.
Right. That's right.
That's what I meant. Oh, this was one of the things I like about the statue very much is it seems as un-Trumpian as a thing can be, that it's welcoming, it's cosmopolitan, it ties us together with Europe, it relies on ordinary people, it embraces immigrant life. It seems like everything we're on the verge of losing is in her. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I don't like to think of it on the verge of as being on the verge of losing.
I'll but handle the weak despair.
I
you
I'm
handle
kind of
the
with you.
Help me.
But I it's threatened. It's clearly threatened, you know. So to pretend that it's not would be really folly. But on the verge of losing may also be up to each one of us, you know.
Do you find the people, as long as I've taken us down this dark alley, has it, in the days since the elections, it changed the way people have come to you? Do they want different things from meditation that they wanted 2 weeks ago?
Yes. I mean, in some ways, yes and no. You know, the no is people have always sought a sense of perspective and not to be defined by the current circumstance they find themselves in. So they want, you could say it in different ways, something deeper or something bigger, you know, that they can feel genuinely connected to, you know, not make believe, but genuinely connected to, so that the circumstances they're in, whatever it might be, are not, it's kind of sealing off all sense of possibility, you know. It's not really defining the sum total of who they are or what they're capable of. People have always wanted that, you know, whether it's because of their, you know, aging parent or their child or their brother or their job or their, you know, crazy mind, which, you know, so restless or whatever, or their physical condition. That's, I think, for all time. But I think there is, you know, at least the people I've seen, you know, clearly a level of despair. And somebody, I was just in California, and somebody said it really well, I think, in this gathering I had. She said, I don't see a way to be coming from a place of love and compassion, which is my biggest value in life, and to be taking action, like to be taking strong action. They seem completely antithetical to me. And they don't seem completely antithetical at all to me.
No, and they wouldn't have to Dr. King either.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
His militant political action was an expression, from his perspective, of his Christian faith. And it was a loving action.
Absolutely.
And it was a pacifist action.
Yes, that's right.
Right?
That's right.
So I hope you set this person straight.
Well,
smack him? Are you ever that kind of man? Just go.
No, I feel like so nice. I said, smack him
in search of a, you know, in pursuit of a greater wisdom.
Yeah, well, it's like, you know, like our mutual friend was saying, fierce compassion, you know, like, they don't seem antithetical at all to me, which is not to say it's easy to find, you know, this week, the expression of one's action quite yet. You know, like,
I don't know what. That's one of the things that plunges me into despair is I don't know what to do. Yeah. And to feel passive is a horrible feeling.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't know how to act.
Yeah. I mean, I think that will come as we're together and working out actions and things like that. But I think that commitment to one's greatest values, however you express that, you know, so that it's not having the suffering define you, you know, and it's not just getting bitter and callous and hateful, and especially not being driven by fear, which has certainly gone around.
I'm a fan of fear, I have to say. I think fear is my friend. That fear gets me to, like, run away from things I should run away from. Fear gets me to think about, well, I have to do something about something. I think fear is very good for us.
Yes.
Fear has stopped me from doing things that I was, in retrospect, and by retrospect I mean 10 seconds, wise not to do. You don't like fear?
No, in the great Buddhist tradition of being excruciatingly precise about the use of language, you know, enough to drive a person crazy, there are different kinds of fear.
Okay.
You know, there is wise fear and appropriate fear. And then there's the fear which just is so consuming that we're paralyzed. Like, we don't see any options, you know? And so it's just being stuck and we collapse. And so, I often say about myself, in terms of things I've seen about my own mind in meditation, that I, unlike the kind of common saying that we're afraid of the unknown, I actually, looking at my own fear, I'm really mostly afraid when I think I do know and it's going to be really bad. And it's the stories I tell myself.
And
that when I remind myself I don't know, and it's like I feel relief. I think, wow, I don't know. There's space.
Right. Ignorance offers possibilities that knowledge forecloses.
Like, if it's actually knowledge. and not...
Darn it, there's always a catch. So I would be wrong then to think of meditation as conservative in the political sense, that it's not teaching people to accommodate themselves to unpleasant circumstances. It's giving them the clarity of mind to respond to them actively?
Yeah, I think...
Well, I've got to write some letters of apology. To some meditation.
We can talk if you want. I mean, it's my world. I understand the other point of view in that the language that's used, and it's not inaccurate, it's just the conventional association with those words would lead one to think meditation is very passive. And mindfulness means accepting things the way that they are, or being with your experience without judging. So it does sound like you're a doormat, really. Yeah.
I don't like to say doormat. Doormat can be such a pejorative term. But
well,
yeah.
It sounds like that.
Yeah.
You know, but it's not meant to be that. It means a more dynamic, creative relationship to what is, rather than having so many old habits come in so quickly to distort that relationship.
So in that sense, not so different from what a really good psychiatrist might want to do, to make you not a prisoner of your past. You don't want to buy this.
No, I can buy it, although I'm not a really good psychiatrist, or a psychiatrist at all.
When the cops find out.
But I think that is definitely part of it. It's not just not being a prisoner of your past. It's not being a prisoner of other influences, like some very strident cultural interpretations of things. Not being a prisoner of your assumptions when you meet a stranger. And not being a prisoner of some of the kind of uniform delusions, really, like... that we are so separate, that we don't live in an interdependent universe. We don't need anybody, you know. Mm-hmm. And there are lots of ways, I think, the structures of society are created around certain delusions, you know.
Yeah.
And so you have to look pretty deeply to work through that.
I thought we might end with, before we take some questions from the audience, with... The Emma Lazarus poem that's inscribed that she wrote for the Statue of Liberty. It's as we know, it's called The New Colossus. And did you know she didn't want to write it? They offered her the job. I don't know who. Someone called her. Do you want to write the? Well, I guess they didn't do this then. Do you want to write this poem? And she said, I can't write a poem for a statue. She didn't want to write for anything in it. But she thought about it for a while. And she did write something. Would you read it?
Sure, now I'll cry. Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame, with conquering limbs astride from land to land. Here at our sea-washed sunset gate shall stand a mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name, Mother of Exiles. From her beacon hand glows worldwide welcome. Her mild eyes command the air-bridged harbor that twin cities frame. Keep, ancient land, your storied pomp, cries she with silent lips. Give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free, the wretched refuse of your teeming shore. Send these, the homeless, tempest-tossed to me. I lift my lamp beside the golden door.
Please join me in thanking Sharon Salzberg.
Thank you.
We'll happily take some questions. I think Tim will explain our procedure.
First of all, the house lights come up. You see, it actually happened.
There you are.
And then we have microphones on either side of the house. So if you have a question, just raise your hand and we'll get those microphones to you in good order. But I just want to thank you on behalf of the Rubin, both of you, Randy and Sharon, for engaging so cogently on the things that matter, using the person and the place and the thing as a conduit to help us understand how things actually work. And you guys were awesome. Thank you so much. in your conversation, there were a few cue words that came up, and one of them was transformational. And it so happens, and the other one was gift, right? So there were two themes there. And so we thought we'd combine those two words into one object, one thing, which is the very first catalogue of the Ruber Museum of Art called Worlds of Transformation, which we want to make a gift to you. So, and this is how this works. There are three of them, and so the chances are quite considerable. And all you need to do is fill out the back of this card in a sort of cursory way. I mean, email is fine. And then we will collect all these cards at the end of the Q&A, give them to Randy, who, being a gambler by nature, will shuffle them like crazy. And then Sharon will pick the three winning cards out of that particular pack. Does that sound like fun or torture? I don't know. But that's what we're going to do. So, and then, you know, during the Q&A, you can pass them to the sides. But in the meantime, who would like to ask a question of either Randy or Sharon about... Yes, we've got a question right here in the first row. Thank you, Joyce.
Hi. I was wondering if you could speak a little bit to... One of the things that I found most heartbreaking in the whole election was the fact that there was such suffering, even the primaries, that would lead so many people to vote for someone who clearly does not have their best interests at heart. And so what I've been really wondering, and I noticed that Van Jones did some really amazing conversations between Trump supporters and Hillary supporters and Bernie supporters, where people found that their interests weren't so different once they got behind the labels. So what I've been really wondering a lot about is, in a culture that seems so siloed and so disconnected from urban and rural and from all these different ways that we define ourselves, and yet we come together with something like the idea of the Statue of Liberty, are there ways in which either of you could speak to that possibility that we could reconnect with those deeper values that we ultimately, I believe, really do share together?
I have no comfort to offer you of any kind. I don't mean to be glib about it, but I just think it's unbelievably awful, and it's only going to get worse. And it's for 4 years, and worse in ways that's going to make life just unspeakably dreadful for our children. He's going to appoint these crackpots to the Supreme Court. They're all like 19 years old. They're going to be holding those judgeships for 50 years. I'm just stammering and stupefied, and that's one of the reasons I feel bad, is that it's not like something just truly tragic has happened, like the death of a parent, where you can somehow find it in you to go on. Today was just like yesterday, except for, you know, the three crackpots he's already naming. But he will continue to act in ways that makes our lives worse and worse. And I don't know how to begin to take action yet. And I hope more... I think this is a political question as much as, if you'll forgive me, as a question about our inner development. And I look to people more politically savvy than I am to give me ways to act.
Yeah, and I think, you know, like I said when we were talking just now, I think those ways to act will appear because there are people far more politically savvy than I who keep telling me it's happening, it's bubbling up, it's local, it's going to be, very community oriented. I don't know yet either, but I think part of what you're saying, I'm not as optimistic as you, or I don't have exactly the same vision that you said. I think to the extent that people feel they know people with very differing views with whom there has been no communication and that there can be communication, that's obviously a good thing. You know,
I don't think it is, frankly. No, I don't. I think we're right and they're wrong.
I agree.
politics for me is not so much about persuading your political rival. I mean, treat people with courtesy and respect. kind of. But you have the privacy of your own thoughts. But politics is about organizing those with fellow feeling, not about persuading those.
Yeah, I agree.
If someone's some horrible racist anti-Semite, and by the way, he should fill out an application for a job because they're hiring, you're not going to persuade that person. I don't want to have them over to my house for dinner. I want to make sure they have no political power. I want to beat that person. I mean, you know, politically.
Yeah, well, I agree with that, actually. You know,
well, I'm not surprised.
Except,
I like you.
I like you, too. We haven't met before. I wouldn't say that conversation is for the sake of persuading, but for the sake of really understanding. And, you know, there are lots of layers, I think, to people who vote either way. You know, look at the media and look at what people are saturated with all the time and what they believe. And, you know, I don't think any effort toward understanding precludes a need toward action. And I think it's
going to
be really interesting times. You know, like what I've said, I was just in California, a couple of different places. And what I kept saying is, you know, I grew up as, you know, in a Jewish family in Washington Heights, and there was so much conversation about people who protected Jews in the Holocaust, and people, you know, was it like the king of Denmark or somebody who went and got the Yellow Star Sun sweater?
Yeah, and in Copenhagen wore that star.
You know, and I thought, okay, Muslim registry, can I do it? Will I do it? And I thought, yeah, I think we all have to do it. You know.
Yeah, we all have to do it, but the idea is to live in a country where no one has to do it.
Oh, but given current circumstances, you said...
I don't have fantasies. I'm essentially a coward, and I don't have fantasies that I'll act heroically. I lack all physical courage. Fear, remember, fear is my
That
friend.
May be why we have one another, you know. If you had to register with 10 million other people, it would be easier, right?
Yeah, I would do the right thing, but I would feel horrible doing it. And I would, you know, that the idea is to avoid this.
Well, I agree.
No,
but
of course you agree, I know.
One of the great things about meditation practice is that it points you to how things actually are, which is so eloquently described before, you know, before we got to understanding, like, I think things are really bad. I think they're going to get a lot worse. I think a lot will be asked of us as individuals, which we will meet in the moment or not. And I can get very dystopian, which I won't on this stage, because every time I do, somebody comes back with a more hopeful perspective. And I think, okay, well, how do I know? I don't know. See, I don't know. No need to be afraid. I don't know.
All right.
I think we need to take Randy on a tour of the museum and introduce him to the Tibetan female deity, of course, Green Tara, who, of course, is the protectress against the eight fears. And the eight fears, as you all know, are really very current and topical ones, like being trampled by wild elephants and being mauled by wild lions, etc. But she has a mantra which I believe was borrowed by a previous legitimately elected president, who said, the only thing we have to fear is fear itself. And you know, you refer to that in this conversation about fear being a paralyzing condition, and her job is to help you understand that fear is born out of a form of ignorance, and ignorance is the major limitation for you to advancing in any way, shape, or form through this life. So, Randy, we'll take you on a personal tour, and you may well find yourself being transformed as a result of that. That's our job here at the Room.
And then you can keep coming back, and we keep checking in how... How are you feeling?
This is great. I've never been a research subject before. I like it.
And then I just recommend you do check out that video from Wednesday, November the 9th, with Ellen Burstyn, who referenced James Baldwin's quote, which I can only paraphrase right now. But he questioned, why is it that people seem to need to hold on to their hatred so vehemently? Is it because if they let it go, they'll have to confront their own pain? And so there are layers, and I think you can better fight the good fight if you have empathy and understand where your so-called opponent is coming from.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that's I think, our job. Okay, next question. Yes, also in the front row. Gosh, these front rows are doing well. Okay, you guys in the back, you better shape up. Yeah.
My question is for Sharon. I've been meditating for many years, but I find in the last couple of weeks that I have such a sense of literal pain in my heart and chest and a sense of contraction that I'm not being skillful at finding a way to find a deeper peace or inspiration or wisdom. And what, as a technique for people who have some notion of meditation, and I've read your books and appreciated mm-hmm. them, but I feel really stuck mm-hmm. and it feels so intense, and I feel the vulnerability is, it has reignited places in my own life when I literally was vulnerable.
Yeah.
And then I magnify that and think, I'm hardly vulnerable at all in reality in this moment compared to all the people you're thinking about and we're all talking, and that woman, you know, that Emma Lazarus wrote about so beautifully, whom we seem to be saying, we don't want to be that anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, my goodness, my anxiety is nothing. And yet I feel stuck and really, what can I do? How can I get relief in some of my body mm-hmm. so that I might be able to more access mm-hmm. wisdom and
mm-hmm.
peace?
It's a great question. I think all of it I can relate to, you know, like we are hardly perhaps the most vulnerable people of all, and yet. So I wouldn't kind of go for peace, you know, so much, but more kind of work with a growing sense of kindness toward yourself with the actual experience you're having, because it will mm-hmm. it will dissolve too, but in its own time. But it's how we relate to it right in the moment that's sort of significant. And you know, so to be with that kind of stuck feeling and the contraction and the difficulty in as kind a way as possible, even if you know loving kindness practice, doing it for yourself in that way. And, you know, it can often feel selfish, especially if you feel that the difficulties of others are so much more intense than what any of us is likely going to face. And yet, we need that sense of respite. We need that sense of refuge. It's sort of, you know, I've often, for a long time, talked about meditation as a practice of resilience, and this is why. And you know, doing loving kindness practice for oneself or taking a break and enjoying something, it feels so selfish and self-centered. But how else do we go on, you know, in a steadier way, but by having that sense of resource inside? So you also have to look for the good. And it sounds so hackneyed, I know, but I have this friend Barbara Fredrickson, who I was on the stage once with, who's a researcher in North Carolina who researches positive emotion. And she has this theory, it's called broaden and build. It's not positive emotion just to like be superfluous and conflict avoidant, but broaden in the sense that when we are locked into fear, locked into greed, locked into hatred, we get tunnel vision. And with something like gratitude for something or generosity or sense of connection, our world opens up. So then we see possible courses of action, which we can't. Actually, you know, it's really spooky. They've done some research. She uses loving kindness meditation as the intervention. That's how we know each other. So they've done some research that if you do something like loving kindness and you feel access to more a positive sense, your peripheral vision actually changes. Isn't that spooky? Like weird, like woo, broaden. And then build, it means inner resource. You don't feel so depleted and so overcome, right? There's something inside that feels like a source of strength or wherewithal. So go for it. You know, we have to take care of ourselves in that sense and remember the good. And also, if you have those techniques, you know, use them to bolster your own sense of of feeling, you know, better.
They just feel like words, but I guess the idea is just to let that be, but keep doing them with the confidence that the stuck is going to slowly unfreeze.
It will unfreeze, and even if it feels like just words, it's okay. And I think, you know, like, be creative. Like, I just told someone I think you should be meditating curled up in the fetal position. I can't remember exactly why I said it. But that was my advice, and she came back to me and said, that really helped. You know, it's like, maybe you're not going to sit in that pristine posture, you know?
Can I suggest something else? Well, maybe you shouldn't get over it too quickly. I mean, I assume you're feeling this way in response to the election. Well, it's not 2 weeks ago. There's this part in Macbeth, do you remember this bit when Macduff has just been told that your wife has been murdered, your children have been murdered, your whole household, they're all slain. And Malcolm, who's trying to get him to start an army, says, avenge it like a man. And Macduff says, but first I must feel it like a man. And maybe it's too soon to act.
That's being kind to ourselves.
Just feel it. Just feel really crappy. That's my advice. And what do I know? You know? For a while, and then get up and fight. But just feel it.
Yeah.
That's part of the kindness.
That's part of the kindness, exactly.
Yeah, the miserable part.
Sharon, would you say that an important part of the practice is to do it on a regular basis? I mean, keep up a consistency? Is that helpful in building resilience? Because if you do it ad hoc, you sort of then allow other emotions to come in and railroad it. Okay, so this is the thing, people. Wednesdays at 1 o'clock, mindfulness meditation here in this room. Sharon's going to be here. This whole series is inspired by Sharon and her work. She's actually going to be here on the 23rd, and she's going to approach how to deal with the unexpected. All right, so that's coming up next Wednesday. Who else would like to ask a question? Oh, gosh, we've got time for just one more question. Right in the back in the middle of the house there. Thanks so much, Farah. Yeah.
Thanks. I'm going to try and come on Wednesday, which sounds like a perfect theme for me, but I haven't been able to really wrap my head around the election, mostly because I've had two friends who've been diagnosed with cancer, and I've also learned about three deaths within my wider social circle. And so I'm wondering if, Sharon, you can say anything that would maybe provide some resilience in that.
Well, this is also, you know, it's like some periods in life, they're just like, what the hell's going on? You know, it's like, I can remember, because I teach often over New Year's, I can remember at the end of 2015, and so many people had such a hard year in the group that I was with, and were saying, God, we can't wait for 2016. You know, things can be really, really hard. And again, you have to take care of yourself, and remember that's how you have the energy to be with somebody else. I mean, when somebody's really ill, you know, I think we tend to be really phobic about saying the wrong thing or doing the wrong thing, but really no one remembers what you said anyway. They just remember that you showed up in some way. And that's what's most important, you know, is... One of the practices that I've had to do with friends of mine suffering in various ways has been really the practice of learning just to be there and not try to fix it. I mean, if they ask, you know, then maybe I have some suggestions, but it's maddening, you know, to have 1,000 people tell you what you need to do. Whether it's psychological distress, which is how I learned it with friends who were really in a bad way, or, you know, physical illness. To be there and hold a kind of space that's just loving. You know, that's our job in a way. And as much as we want someone to survive or get better or flourish, we can be there wholly, fully, and then not feel, you know, betrayed because we couldn't control it. That's very hard for us. But that's why it's like a practice, you know, is doing it. I'll also say that, as just a sort of side note, when people ask all the time if you're actually sitting with somebody who's dying, what to say, and from the Buddhist tradition, they say, remind them of the good that they've done. And I always thought that was weird. I thought, that's so weird, like, you know, because then they'll be even more attached to life, because, you know, you were a great aunt or friend, you were a great friend. Remember when we went to Washington Square Park and we did all those outrageous things, and you really gave me the courage to step out and do it. And I thought, oh, they're going to hold on, they're going to suffer even more. What a terrible thing to suggest. But because, you know, that was what I'd been taught, it's what I always tell everybody. And every single time people have come back and said to me, it was the perfect thing. You know, it just changed the energy in the room. It was a way of, it's like affirming love. And instead of regret, you know, and things undone and stuff like that. And it really freed the person to kind of move on in some way. So there are ways in which we can learn from one another, you know, just sort of at least suggestions for how we can be there, you know, in the best way.
That's why this series is called Wisdom. Thank you, Sharon, and thank you, Randy, so much.